Take me where the promises are real.
Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to this Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in their personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what's happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker tonight. I just met her this evening, but we were speaking before the meeting, and I think that you're going to be in for a really good ride of a story, and I really want to also point out, if you're a particularly young person, I think you should really pay attention to this story. So with that, I give you Mary. I appreciate the introduction, but I hope it's a good ride. I don't know. If I see people leaving, I'll try and change it. My name is Mary. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Thank you for this opportunity and for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope with you all. By the grace of God, and I always get teary-eyed saying this, I have been sober one day at a time for 13,688 days. I got sober when I was 22, over 37 years ago. And I do not say this braggingly. I say this because it is not by my doing. It is by the doing of this program, how it works, the fellowship of this program for sure, and that. So with that, I just want you to know that I humbly stand before you and telling you my story. So I grew up, like so many of us, grew up in an alcoholic home, had an alcoholic father and a very codependent mother. My mother, probably in hindsight, she probably was could have been diagnosed as manic depressive because she was almost as crazy as my father. You know, and that's all I remember growing up is, you know, the highs, the lows. It was either great or it really sucked. There was really no in between. I grew up in a, you know, middle class family, average. We weren't rich. We weren't necessarily poor. But, you know, that, and I just always remember the ups and the downs and always going through the week wondering how drunk my parents were going to be with the neighbors or relatives on the weekend and what kind of weekend it would be. And I do remember vowing very early I would never, ever be like my parents and, you know, live that kind of lifestyle. And lo and behold, at 14, I had my first drink. My parents would go out on the weekends, and so I had a girlfriend over. She slept over, and of course we raided my parents' liquor cabinet, took some, I think, vodka, gin, whatever, you know, poured us some two healthy glasses of vodka for each of us, filled up the bottle with water so that, you know, my parents would be suspicious, blah, blah, blah. And I remember taking that first drink, and I spit it out because it tasted so awful. And then I looked over at my girlfriend. She was 14 as well. And she, good to see some faces here. Thanks for the support, you guys. But I noticed her just guzzling it. I'm like, oh, well, hell, if she can do that, I can do it. So despite not liking the taste of that, I guzzled that glass, that huge glass. And, of course, it hit me immediately, and I barely remember. It was probably my first blackout, certainly not my last. But I barely remember the evening except for getting sick before my parents came home, throwing up, and thinking that I had, like, you know, had it all cleaned up, there was no evidence, any of that kind of thing. And I remember passing out, next, you know, my girlfriend and I don't be honest, I don't even remember what she did. I don't even know. I just remember passing out in my bed and waking up to my dad saying, young lady, you better get up and you better get up now. And the irony of that whole thing is my father was pretty damn drunk that night too. But here he was going to reprimand me because he showed me where I'd gotten sick, and it was anywhere but the toilet. I'll just say that, not to gross you out. But that's my first drink. And you would think, because I like to consider myself sort of sane, you would think that that would be enough of a knock, knock, you shouldn't be doing this. But unfortunately, it was not. It just, so at 14, had my first drink. It was awful, and I kept going back. And I'm sure not much, you know, not unsimilar to many stories here. And, you know, did the high school thing, did the junior high thing, got drunk at football games with friends, things like that. The good news, so I thought at the time, was that I was able to hide my drinking to some degree. My mother was like a bloodhound with that stuff because, of course, she lived with an alcoholic, so she was always aware of his, you know, his egregious behavior, his indiscretions, his getting drunk. But the good news was because he was that way, or the bad news, I thought it was good at the time, I could, like, come home with a 12-pack, drink it, hide, like, the beer cans that I didn't drink. If she ever found them, I could blame them on my dad, and she never questioned that. So that, you know, as a 15-year-old drinking and trying to not get caught, that was kind of exciting, sadly. So that's kind of my story. Went through high school, and by the time I reached high school, things were really bad in my household. You know, my father, I'll tell you this about my father, I'll get teary-eyed again telling you this. He is one of the kindest souls that you will ever meet. And everybody says that about him until he drinks. And then he is a raging, mofo, violent, angry man. And he would beat me. He would beat my mother. I would try and protect my little sister from that. So unfortunately, she never got it. But that just goes, it reminds me now, and I didn't really realize it at the time, just how much alcohol can change us. And it can make us the people we are not, we don't want to be, we are not meant to be, we just wouldn't be otherwise. And, you know, every year, every day I stay sober, I realize that more and more, like, wow, this man who is the salt of the earth is really a raging, you know, we've all had those issues with our parents, but again, that's just a good reminder of how that can flip our switch to the dark side. And I was no exception to that at a young age. So in high school, when things started getting really bad in my home life, and my father was out having affairs, coming home, my parents would get in arguments, I'd start physical fighting, I'd try and break it up, I'd get beat up, that kind of thing. I thought, I'm not going to drink, even for fun, on a Friday night with my friends at the football game. I'm not going to do it. I don't want to be like my father. I don't want to have a household like this. I don't want to do this. So I did manage to put down the drink. However, because, you know, I wasn't really working a program and didn't really admit that I was powerless or any of that kind of thing, I went right into drugs. So drugs is a part of my story. And so I was able not to drink, but then I'm doing all kinds of drugs, and I'm doing all kinds of drugs with the drug addicts in high school. And that's bad when you're sitting outside at the high school doing things, you know, shooting up or smoking or taking whatever they have to offer you or whatever you can get your hands on. But I thought I was okay because I wasn't drinking, and I was not like my father. That's how idiotic and how cunning and baffling this disease is, and how it can make us think all these weird thoughts that we're okay when we clearly are not. And that's, you know, so I got into drugs, and of course that eventually led me back to drinking. And so by the time I was a senior in high school, I was probably drinking a quart of rum, probably a couple times a week. Because my parents were fighting all the time. It was just shitty. My dad left. My parents were going to get a divorce. You know, and I always thought I was part of the, you know, cleavers, I guess, for lack of a better term, and that would never happen to us, despite how tumultuous my upbringing was with that. So my dad left, and my mom, she just could not get over it. And my sister was a junior in high school. I was graduating from high school, and My dad was pretty much an asshole and kept drinking and was having affairs and went and lived with this woman he was having an affair with, and it sent my mom over the edge. And I'd come home from high school and she'd just be laying on the couch crying and not knowing how to deal with life. And here I am, 17, and I have to try and figure out for her and my sister, like, what the heck to do. And so I think that, too, really compounded my use. And I, like I said, I would use not drinking that much, maybe a quart a week, because I was drugging that much. So, when they say that this is a, you know, you can substitute one for the other, I'm a prime example of that. And know that, and that's why I share with you. Some people get some people in the room, AA rooms, don't like hearing about drug use, but it's a huge part of my story, and it's why I felt like I wasn't an alcoholic, because I was busy doing all sorts of drugs that I shouldn't have been doing, and then I was able to not drink like I had once before. So, so long story short, you know, one thing after another kept happening. I kept thinking I was fine and cool. My poor mom, she just, like, we had to bring her to the hospital all the time because she was crying so much and not eating and not drinking even water, that she dehydrated herself and she had these crazy mood swings and all of that. And so, you know, throughout that I'd be like, I can deal, I can take care of this, I can manage this myself, my drug use, my drinking, any of that, all of that. You know, and like I remember one night I just, you know, I'm still young at this point. I'm 17, maybe 18, maybe 19. Going out with friends and trying to have a good time and trying to have a normal good time, you know, getting all, you know, dressed up and things like that. And I remember my friends and I went to this really fancy restaurant in Minnesota. And I'm from Minnesota, excuse me, I forgot to tell you that. And you guys are stuck with me, by the way. I moved here a couple of years ago and you guys are stuck with me. But I remember going with my friends, a group of friends, and like I said, I, you know, put on some makeup and this, I bought myself a new skirt and stuff. We were going to have a good time. And I remember thinking, I had never felt cooler than I did that night. I don't know exactly why. I think I got everything kind of tweaked just right, just enough drinking, just enough drugs, and just like felt so cool. So I go use the restroom, and I come back, and, you know, walking through the, my friends were parked way over on the other side of the restaurant, walking through, and people are looking at me, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I got this, I'm good. I get to the table, my girlfriend says, turn around. I go, what? She goes, no, just, so I turn around, didn't see anything. She goes, no, just look over your shoulder, and I look, and I had gotten toilet paper caught in my skirt, and I'm dragging a whole long thing of toilet paper through the restaurant thinking I am so cool, you know. So this is like the kind of stuff that would happen to me all the time. And yeah, it's kind of funny now, but I'll be damned if that wasn't just like the epitome of every time I thought things were good or it was okay, crap like that would happen. And like I said, I got sober a long time ago by the grace of God. And so I did a lot of drunk driving and drunk driving while I was on drugs. And to this day, I do not stop saying thank you to God, my higher power, for not, that I did not kill myself, but more so that I did not kill anybody else driving like that, ever. I should have gotten some DUIs, but back then, sadly, it was easy. If you got pulled over because you were swerving or swaying or going in and out of your lane while driving, I go in and out of my lane all the time, but I'm not driving at least, sorry. You could hand them your driver's license and a $50 to $100 bill, and they'd say thank you and give you your driver's license back. Not cool. Not cool at all. But that's the only reason why I don't have a DUI, when I should have probably had a dozen of them. So it's things like that that kept me thinking, oh, you know, I'm okay, or I'm sort of okay. I kind of got this under control. I don't have any DUIs. You know, a couple friends of mine got DUIs, and I'm like, well, this is where you carry 100. That's why you carry 100 in your pocket, right? For those moments when you get pulled over, you know. But they didn't do that, so they got DUIs. So then I was able to say, well, I don't have a problem because I didn't get a DUI. And they did. So I went to college and, you know, the partying thing was, sorry, and the partying thing and still the same thing. And you know, where I was out a lot. And at this point, I wasn't talking to my dad because he had met the, he had an affair and he was living with this woman, so I didn't want to have anything to do with him. And my mom, I think she probably, in hindsight, probably should have been hospitalized, but I didn't know that. My sister didn't know that. So trying to maintain that and go to college and party like I like to and stuff. And so when I would go out, three times this happened to me. I would drink too much or use too many drugs or whatever and be so, I would fall. And the first couple times that happened, I'd like scrape my elbows or my hands. One time I scraped my face, but I thought, oh, you know, like I was kind of roughhousing or running around the parking lot with people and like it was their fault, right? Because it never really was my fault. And I know you all can agree. I mean, look at me. Like, really? Not my fault, right? As we all say to ourselves. But I think the thing that got, a couple things happened. When I was in college, I was at a party. Of course, there was a lot of drinking and drugging there. And somebody that was at the party hung themselves at that party. And I think that was kind of the thing that started me thinking, wow, this is really not right. And for the first time, I could say, I think I might be like my dad. And plus, I was really an angry, violent drunk, just like my father. Like, I was always provoking fights or physically getting in fights and stuff like that. If somebody would smart off to me, I'm sure it's hard to believe because I look like such a wallflower, but I would smart off back to them and provoke, and it would be game on. So I was doing things like that when that really, I didn't want to be like my father, who was violent, and that really didn't feel like me. So one night again, I was at a party, imagine that. And there was a lot of drinking, and I was playing some drinking game with some guy that was about three times the size of me, so he could hold about three times more liquor than I could. And, of course, I got totally messed up, and I was walking out of the party, and it was March in Minnesota. And if any of you know of the Minnesota climate, March in Minnesota is sheer ice on everything, sheer ice. So you better be walking around sober, not drunk, because you're going to fall on your ass and God knows what's going to happen. Seriously. So I came out of the party, and again, a friend that I had gone there with, he's trying to help me get to the car. And of course, I'm like, I don't need your help and I'm fine. And I'm pushing him away and stuff and slid and fell on my butt and slid down. And he's like, I need to get you home. So he put me in the car, and I don't remember the ride home, but I do remember he tried to, the apartment I lived in had these long stairs going up into the apartment, and he was trying to help me up the stairs. And again, like I said, it's March in Minnesota, and it's just sheer ice, these stairs. And he's like, steps. And he's like, here, let me just help you up the stairs, get you into your apartment, and I'll go. I'm like, again, I don't need your help, I'm fine, blah, blah, all that same old BS that, you know, our disease will tell us isn't true. And so I did. I remember trying to push him away, and he moved, and I went down. And this time, I went down on my face on the concrete stairs. And I when I got popped up, or he helped me up, it must have been awful, because I remember the look on his face already. It must have been awful. Like, I remember bleeding and blood coming down into my eye and stuff. And he's like, I need to get you inside. And again, you know, like I said earlier, when I would look at my dad and say, oh, I'm never going to be like my dad, or I'm not going to be like that, yet I did the same thing and still had denial about how bad my drinking was, how bad my use was. Same thing. He's like, I need to get you inside. We should call the doctor, hospital or whatever he said. I'm like, I'm fine, I'm fine. So he just wanted to have nothing to do with me, and I can't say that I blame him. And he was one of my amends, the people I'd made amends to in my amends step. But he just, I think just, I don't even remember, threw me in my apartment. What I remember next is going to my cupboard and getting a drink. I can't even remember, probably rum. And I remember sitting down at my table alone. I could remember blood kind of coming down my eye, but not even caring about it. The next thing I remember is waking up, pulling my head off the table, and it was kind of blood and whatever else would all congealed and like set up. So I remember like hearing this loud like kind of like you're peeling a Band-Aid off your arm or something, as I popped my head up. And I went into the bathroom and I screamed because I did not recognize myself. I had a big, huge abrasion that had been bleeding out, a cut on my forehead. My eyes were already starting to turn black and blue. My nose was all swollen. For some odd reason, I didn't lose any teeth and I didn't break my nose. I'm not sure why. But I barely recognized myself. And I had that apartment for about 3 months, and this was at the height of my using. And I remember my mom, and this is back when I had a cell phone. Yes, unfortunately, I'm old enough to say I had a cell phone that plugged into my car, and it was about as big as this podium. And my mother calling me every day on that cell phone saying, "What are you going to do? How are you? You need treatment." I'm like, "Mom, seriously? Yeah, whatever, bye." And I also, when I found that apartment, moved way out, so like from where I grew up, because I had been living at home when I started college. But I remember going way out, so I knew she wouldn't just like drive by and stop by. So long story short, I remember having to go out to the car to get this big cell phone and make this call to my mom. And I knew how I looked, and I was just like crying. And by that time, I had started this internship at this company that I was going to school for, engineering. And so I had started an internship with this company. And the other thing that would happen is, like, I was the only female with this company, because back it was the early 80s, and there weren't really many women in engineering. And it was me and the boys always going out drinking all the time and getting messed up and whatnot. And so that was of no help either. Not one of them said, you know, "You might have a problem, Mary," or anything like that. So I called my mom, and she goes, "Oh, I'm glad you called." And back then you could have beds waiting in a treatment center. And so she had a bed waiting in a treatment center for me. So that was like on a Sunday. Excuse me. So Monday she came and picked me up, and she took me to the treatment center and went through the evaluation with sitting there looking like probably what somebody from one of the zombies from The Walking Dead look like nowadays, sitting there and taking this eval, still saying I didn't have a problem, still saying I could control it, still saying that, you know, if I just did this, if I cut out that, if I, you know, maybe went down to just a couple drinks, I could control, and I wouldn't fall again, I wouldn't get in fights, I wouldn't get pulled over and have to pay $100 so I don't get a DUI, all of these things. Still sitting there saying that. And I remember the person evaluating me said, "You know what? Give me your purse. You're in here. You're going to stay here." And back then they had, I was 22, and she put me into an inpatient treatment. And I was in a young person's group, and that was a 30-day program. And the whole time, none of this applied to me. I was not like any of you. I just knew I could dry out, kind of regroup, rethink, reshuffle, and I wouldn't be like my dad, and I wouldn't need all of the stuff treatment was throwing at me, and I wouldn't need this after the fact. I remember thinking that. And, of course, at 22, you know, you feel invincible and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, trying to get sober at 22 is probably, I was talking to Julie earlier, she said, fortunately, I didn't have any foresight at 22, because you just kind of, you know, you're invincible, and at least I didn't. Maybe I'm kind of dumb. Well, I probably am, but I didn't think about the future, except that I knew I didn't want to stop drinking. I knew that. That's all I knew about my future, is that I didn't want to stop drinking, and that when I saw that Half Measures Availed Us Nothing, I thought, I'm going to be rewriting that book. I'll show you all. Half measures, no problem. I got this. And as we all know, it didn't work that way. So I went through treatment, and then they suggested highly that I go to a halfway house. And back then, that was kind of common. I don't think it's common that much anymore now because of insurance and all that. But so this job that I had, they had to hold a spot for me. They paid for my treatment, and I went to the halfway house for 6 months, and I got into a young people's group. And the only good news about that young people's, well, not only, I mean, of course, you know, treatment was treatment, and you have to go through and do all the steps formally and things like that, And I know I went in there thinking, again, that I was different. But slowly, I suppose, things started sinking in, although I didn't really realize it. But I've probably been in the halfway house a couple months, and then they said, you can start going to meetings outside of here. You have to go. You have to, you know, that kind of thing, and you have to get a sponsor. And I thought, okay, fine, I'll get a sponsor. I'll do what it says just so I can get out of here, get, you know, 6 months in the halfway house, be done, and go back out and do it. Do everything controlled now, right? Control my drinking, control my drug use if I was going to do that, whatever. So I was sitting and I went to a couple different AA meetings, and this one had this older man. I was 22 and he was probably 72, 70-ish. He and his wife went to this meeting every night that I was there. And he called himself Beautiful Mac. And I thought, if somebody's got the balls to call themselves Beautiful Mac at 72, I want him as my sponsor. And I know you're not supposed to have opposite sex as sponsors, but he and his wife became my sponsors. And I regretted it the minute I did it, because he kicked my you-know-what. He wiped up the floors of AA with me, I gotta say. And it was a perfect thing, he and his wife being my sponsors. And to this day, 37 years later, I still remember a lot of things that he said. And one of the first things he told me was, you know, I'd be like, yeah, you know, my life was unmanageable, but I'm not, you know, I could probably control it. I'm not sure, I'm powerless. And he goes, stop right there. And I go, well, what? It was unmanageable. You know, yeah, I can see what you're talking about with unmanageability. He goes, no. That's not what I'm talking about. I want you to read the first step. So I read the first step. We are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. And I'd say to him, yeah, I told you my life was unmanageable. He goes, and I'm not sure if I'm powerless or not. And he goes, that's not what it says. It says we are powerless. Yeah, you are powerless when you say, I am powerless, or you think you're not powerless when you say, I am not powerless. But it is the word we. And he goes, and I want you to hear that word right now, right here. It's the first word of the first step in this program of recovery. It is a we program. And I'll never forget him telling me that and you know, really beating that pretty much into my head. And so once I started getting that concept, I started thinking, okay, maybe this is what I need. Maybe this is what we need. Maybe this could work for me if I make it a we program and do what you all or we are saying to do. All the time I was in the young person's small group in my halfway house, and unfortunately, one by one, they would leave or they would go out and start using, and we'd get word that they had OD'd or killed themselves. And so this is what I was talking to Julie about earlier. I think that really stuck with me at 22. Like, everybody that was in my young, I believe I'm the only person alive from that group to this day. And so that kind of thing just was like another wake-up call, like, oh, geez, if that is what this is about, that could definitely happen to me. And so I think that kind of stuck with me. And the whole time, Beautiful Mac, you know, making me sit down and go through my steps and still calling himself Beautiful Mac. And I wanted to, ain't that beautiful? You're making me do all this crap I don't want to do. But like I said, he and his wife kicked my butt, and they were great. And I, to this day, I've lost track of him several years ago, unfortunately, or decades ago, maybe now. He probably, it's probably passed, but I bet you he passed with a smile on his face saying he's Beautiful Mac. So, like I said, I got through the halfway house and got out and went back to work and just decided I was really unhappy with the career that I had chosen and wanted to do something different. So I figured out something different. I moved to New York to become a makeup artist, and that's what I do today. I'm a makeup artist in the film industry, and it may sound glamorous, but it really is just a job. So I moved to New York to go to school for that and kind of try and make my way. And I'll tell you another thing that hit me hard on the head when I moved to New York. I lived on the Upper West Side, and I'd go to meetings up by, if anybody knows anything about New York, I'd go to meetings up on the Upper West Side, north of where I lived. I lived on 72nd and Broadway. I'd go up into meetings in like 100, 125 up by the Apollo. And back then in the early 80s, mid-80s, it was still pretty wild in New York. And some of the meetings I go to, like, seriously, there was one meeting that was probably one of the best meetings in keeping me sober, but I walked through a shooting gallery, which means you're walking through where people are passed out from drinking, drugs, whatever, to get to the meeting on the third floor, and you had to walk up three flights of stairs. And I will say that if that isn't, you know, enough to keep reminding me what this disease is capable of, I'm just grateful. Not that I... That wasn't me, and there is that saying that, but for the grace of God. So I lived in New York and got into a different field, got into the film industry. And I didn't talk to my dad for the first 3 years. I was sober because he was still drinking. He was still a raging alcoholic, and I was still really rageful at him for the way that we brought up. And I really tried hard to take care of my mother, codependently so, because, you know, she had so many emotional issues and things like that. So that was still going on. It was still pretty hard. But at one point I remember thinking, you know, they got these steps here. Dang it. And they talk about, you know, making amends and things like that. And my sponsor, Beautiful Mac, would say, you need to put your mom, you need to put your dad on there, and you need to say, you know, you're sorry. And I'm like, well, I'm not sorry for anything, because it was all them. They're the reason why I used and drank, and my life was effed up and miserable. And, you know, so it took me quite probably a good year to digest what he was telling me, and for me not to be belligerent and defiant and finally say, all right, I'll put him on the list, but I'm not doing anything about it. And I remember writing it on my list and then tucking it away. And like I said, probably about 3 years later, I remember, and my father remarried this woman he was having an affair with, so that was a whole another issue to just, like, be bitter about and things like that. And I remember saying, Beautiful Max saying, it's time you make amends to your parents. And I'm like, well, they are on my list, but half measures avail us everything, don't they? I don't really have to say I'm sorry to my parents. Do I? Like, it was all their fault. And he's like, no, you do. You need to figure out what you did and apologize. And he goes, and I guarantee, and I will never forget this. He said, I guarantee you it'll open doors you never thought needed to be opened. And so, as we all have to, I mustered up the courage to, you know, at least say I was sorry. And I wasn't even sure what about what, but I just, it was a interesting thing because my dad got teary-eyed. He was sober. I made sure he was sober when I told him, when I talked to him about that. And my mom, of course, she's so emotional. God, I love you, Mom. She's since passed, but she was so emotional. She just grabbed me and started crying. And I knew you'd see the light and all this. And I'm like, Jesus, Mom, okay, your turn. But that didn't ever happen. But my point is this. This is a program for us. It is these things that we do that make the difference, not what other people do and not how they treated us and what that made us do. And the longer I'm sober, the more and more that just is so clear to me. But so I did that, and I think that probably was one of the first steps towards grace of this program in these rooms, and me having a different kind of program where I did want to believe in God. I did want to have hope. I knew that I wanted to stay sober one day at a time for a very long time. And I knew I needed help doing that. I knew we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable, and I am certainly a part of that we. By the grace of God, I have not gone back out on the streets and back to drugging or drinking in the time I've been around. Again, that's not any credit to me. I give all the credit to you in these rooms. I'll tell you a little bit about my sobriety. Maybe hopeful, maybe not. Maybe I'll be like, oh, God. Maybe she's an example of what not to do, as I tell my grandkids. So my 20s were great. Got sober. I lived euphorically in my 20s. Hit 30, thought, geez, I need to be married and start raising a family. So all this is going to happen. Married a man that I knew in the program. He was sober. He was an asshole. He was 10 years older than I do, and I say that. He was also on my list, and I did apologize to him too, but I'll still to this day say he was kind of an asshole. But long story short, that didn't last long. And so got a divorce from him, lived another, you know, few years celebrating and my freedom, and then got married again because I wanted kids. And he was 10 years younger than me, and we lost a couple of kids, and so I didn't have any children. And he wanted to have children of his own, biological children, so that kind of, we decided amicably to split up. And the reason why I'm telling you my horror story, no, my story is, I'll get to my long-winded point in a minute. So then I, you know, had a relationship with a man, lived with him for a few years, and then finally met the love of my life. And we were together almost 10 years, got married, and then he passed. And the reason why I'm telling you this is not because I want you to feel sorry for me or any of that, but because, you know what? Life sucks. I wish I could tell you differently. It really sucks. And drunk, it's worse. Sober, at least we got some tools to deal with life and how much it sucks. And I wish I could say that life did not get better, but I got better at life getting sober. Life did not get better, but I got better at life. And I've made different choices and better choices. And throughout all the things that have happened, good and bad, in my sobriety, and a lot of good have happened, I feel, I wake up, and some days I have to work to be grateful, but I really try to have, you know, be grateful each day. Because for me, that's a key to me, staying sober. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I'm pissed, I am raging right now at somebody, and, you know, I'm praying about it, I got them on the list, it's all tucked away, I know Beautiful Mac is saying, you better look at that and go say you're sorry and figure out what you need to do to make that right, and I'm like, yeah, whatever, you know, you're up there, I'm down here, you don't know, but long story short, these are the conversations I have, welcome to my world. But long story short, it's always on me. My sobriety is my responsibility, and it's always on me. And it's on me to pick up these tools. It's on me to make I into we, to connect, to be a part of this fellowship. These are the things that are on me. And I don't, again, say that braggartly. I say that humbly. And if I do not say that humbly and think that it's I braggartly, then humbly there is no we for me in this program. My life is fantastic, and it's hard, and I walk around with a heavy heart some days because I've had a lot of loss, as I'm sure a lot of people have. But what I'm most grateful for is that I've gone through this sober, one day at a time, for 37 years by the grace of God and the fellowship and program of AA. That's the only reason I've made it through all these things. And I don't feel any different than anybody else here, because I can imagine that there are probably some stories that are worse than mine, but we're all in this together. And any newcomers or anybody that's struggling, hang in there, connect with fellow people, you know, from AA, work the steps. They are trite and they do suck. And I always told Beautiful Mac that, and he would always say, you'll realize one day they're not. And you're like, well, 37 years later, I'm still saying it sometimes, but there are these days. And the best thing about this program is it's progress, not perfection. And the only thing that I have to do perfectly is not drink or drug. Everything else, it's a roll of the dice, and I pick up my tools to get back and talk myself off the ledge and get back to where I want to be. And I will say this, no longer am I that angry young woman walking around ready to curse somebody out or punch them in the face. And here, I'll close with this real quick. My mother passed 10 years ago. My parents got a divorce. My father, like I said, remarried this woman. They were married for like 37 years. She passed. Or whatever. She passed. My father is still an alcoholic. However, when my husband passed and my stepmom passed, my father and I were given a gift. where we would spend a lot of time together. And when I lived in Minnesota before moving down here a couple of years ago, we would spend a lot of time together. And I could look at him as the man I wanted him to be. We kind of came to a verbal and silent agreement that he would not drink in front of me. And on a rare occasion, he'll have a couple sips, because he has to, because he's been drinking for God knows how long, you know, 80 years, and needs that. But my point is this: we have had, because of God's grace, and because of me deciding that I needed to do, own my stuff with him, things were open for me to then accept this, however many decades later, where he and I have spent time, and I have had some amazing moments with my father. And they have helped me see myself, and they have been such a gift, because despite him being that mofo, I grew up with him, even though he's still drinking, he's 85, he's slowed down, he's not quite that man that he used to be. And now I can see, you know, how this program works and gives us these opportunities. And if I weren't open to them, if I didn't work the steps and talk to you all and be a part of this fellowship, I wouldn't have missed that. I would, if I were to go tomorrow, I'd go angry at my dad for all his effed up behavior. But there was that one point a few years ago, he did apologize for it. So, I mean, that's what these are the kind of things this program has. And so when they read these promises at these meetings, you better believe that they're going to come true. And that it's our job to sit here and console each other and hold hands and talk with each other and rejoice with each other that if we wait, they'll happen. And so with that, I want to say thank you very much, and best of luck to you all, and have a good night, I guess.
Thank you very, very much. Said a lot of things that I really could resonate with, and very powerful story. Thank you for that. Tinsley's going to come up and get out Chip's clean.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Tinsley. And that was a great story. I really enjoyed it. I go to meetings in Minnesota, and I really enjoy meetings up there. A lot of friends in recovery there.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waken there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. For something that set me free, and I'd arrive to a world in harmony. See love as a vision that one day would appear to me.
Take me where the promised land.